This is an interview with Shabtai Rosen at the University of Virginia Law School on June 12, 1990. This portion of the interview will be dealing with the question of the Suez War in 1956. Mr. Rosen, what was your role in Israel at this particular time around the Suez Crisis?
Well, at that time I was still legal advisor of the Foreign Office in Foreign Ministry in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
I put it this way, as I believe I may have mentioned, that there's a continuum from really the beginning right through to Camp David about freedom of navigation through both the Suez Canal and the Strait of Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
The two were linked. We had thought at Rhodes, the armistice, in some of our later conversations with Bunch,
mm-hmm.
that the problem of Suez was resolved by the armistice agreement. The problem of Tehran had not yet really arisen.
Mm.
We knew of the existence of the strait, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They were used very little at that time. As I said, one of our objectives there was to get this land, only a few miles, on the Red Sea in order to give us this outlet to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when Bunch's report to the Security Council of August 1948, when he completed the last of the armistice negotiations with Syria, was a half sentence which we didn't like very much, but it was not really what we thought we were going to get. And I don't remember the exact wording, but it said something about, and all vestiges of war or war conditions will be removed, something words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
That was intended, generate as far as we were concerned, when we negotiated. Here again, Eitan can probably tell you more about it. About this, to deal with freedom of passage through the Suez Canal,
mm-hmm.
which, as you know, had come up through the armistice procedures and through the Security Council, led to the Security Council resolution of 1st September of 51, which, by the way, was my first appearance attending Security Council meetings, was brought over,
mm-hmm.
because my colleague Robinson, whom I mentioned, he was over in Israel on something else, and we simply had to swap positions.
I see. So, and during that time,
that's where I got my
UN in New York.
UN was in New York. That's mm-hmm. where I got my introduction to the Security Council. I'd been in General Assembly before that.
Mm-hmm. And what was the nature of your presentation?
I didn't present it. Eban did the speaking in the Security Council, but I was the legal advisor. I knew quite a lot about the Suez Canal. Apart from the fact I'd lived there.
That's right. Yeah.
During the war, and mm-hmm. knew it physically also quite well. So did Eban, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure we didn't know it physically better than some of the Egyptians, because it's not an area frequented much by Egyptians, at any rate south of Ismailia.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Tehran issue began coming to the fore, I would say, around late in 1949, early 1950, as far back as that,
mm-hmm.
when there was an exchange of correspondence through the U.S. Embassy in Cairo with the Egyptians. A little bit obscure. That was when they occupied these islands. They had been unoccupied, and I think technically belonged to Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And the Egyptians put a small army unit on it, and the straits are very narrow there, a few hundred yards wide,
right.
and can be controlled by one cannon on the shore.
Mm.
The cannon's probably still there. We in the Foreign Ministry, already as early as that, we began thinking that there was only going to be one way to get the Egyptians off those straits, and that was by force.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't see them moving voluntarily. Now, when Hammarskjöld came in 1956, in the summer of 1956, a great deal of his time and attention was spent in trying to settle what had by that time already become a twin problem,
mm-hmm.
of the Suez Canal and Tehran. There are major legal differences between the two, because the Suez Canal is governed by the Suez Canal Convention of 1888. Well, the Straits of Tehran are matters of general international law, which at that time was in a state of major flux, because it was just before the first conference on the law of the sea was convened. Now, these are all connected, these matters. You'll see why in a few minutes. Hammarskjöld very much thought that the two questions of freedom of passage through Suez and freedom of passage in Strait of Tehran should go to the International Court for an advisory opinion. And he at one time, at any rate, thought that Israel would lose on the Suez Canal issue and win on the Strait of Tehran issue. Now, that was never my opinion. My opinion was that the risk of losing on both was extremely high. You never can tell in a court, but...
What were Israel's objectives in this particular case?
East Africa, trade with East Africa.
Trade with East. So they wanted basically freedom of passage.
Freedom of passage, yes, yes, that's all.
That's all.
That's enough. I mean,
that's a lot.
That's what all the Law of the Sea conferences were about, more than anything else.
But not control or anything?
No, 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 freedom of passage. Yeah. And overflight.
And overflight.
Now, how are these connected? I think we managed to persuade Hammarskjöld to drop this idea, well, we did persuade him to drop this idea of going to the International Court. Although, if you take President Eisenhower's statement after the Suez War of 1957, around March, I think it was, he does talk about until judicially determined or till something, uses words to that effect. I think John Foster Dulles also was thinking along those lines. Now, in after the Suez War, the major issue that arose, we couldn't do anything about it as far as we were concerned, was how to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, where the pressures were very great. By the way, in parenthesis, I think in retrospect, completely misplaced, and if I may continue with a parenthesis for a minute, bunch of technicians, technical, high-level technical experts from the office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva came to look at the Gaza Strip and help us while we were in occupation of it in that period, and they thought we could have solved the problem then very much, and they were ready to help. But of course, here again, the UN intervened. It belonged to the UNRWA, the Special Organization of Palestinian Refugees, and they wanted nothing to do with the High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva, where there was tremendous expertise at that period in settling large numbers of people, because it was still post-war period. And they were sort of more or less kicked out when we left. Now, there were very long and difficult negotiations with the Americans, especially, with the UN also, because Hammarskjöld was a strong personality, as you know. Had his own interests and UN interests. The American delegation handled these negotiations mainly with Mrs. Meir, who then became foreign minister. Was headed by a very prominent lawyer named Arthur Dean, who was from the firm of Sullivan Cromwell, from which John Foster Dulles came. This is a link-up. Arthur Dean was afterwards head of the U.S. delegation to the first and second conference on the law of the sea in 1958 and 1960. Now, here you've got a tremendous link-up of a series of complicated issues. We felt, we said this to Hammarskjöld and to the Americans, that the question of Tehran could be solved through the conference on the law of the sea. And it would be ridiculous for a government to put that kind of issue to a court where it loses control of the operation at a certain period, a major operation of that kind. As far as Suez was concerned, we said, look, the Egyptians are simply down, we've got to open the canal. That's what the Suez Canal Convention says, that's what the Security Council Resolution says. But of course it didn't happen that way. The major major objectives in the Suez War, as far as we were concerned, I think were two. Nasser had started organizing the Fedayeen, which of course is what developed into the PLO in one form or another, as part of the Egyptian intelligence from the Gaza Strip. They were beginning to cause a nuisance. And at the same time, we wanted to get, at any rate, freedom of passage through Tehran in order to develop our trade with the Far East and East Africa. Those were the major objectives. Well, I think we actually got both, to tell the truth, in the end, although it was difficult. Mrs. Meteor's speech, or the 1st of March, I think it was, 1957, in the General Assembly, was negotiated, took several, 2 or 3 months to negotiate that speech. It was negotiated primarily in New York, between her advisors in New York, and Arthur Dean and his advisors, and Hammarskjöld and his advisors. And I was the backup in Jerusalem with, as far as the government was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I had to continue afterwards, of course, as head of the delegation, or number two in the delegation, to the First Law of the Sea Conference, where we got the clause through, which is often regarded as the Aqaba Clause, which partly, I would say, settled the thing, because the UN had an observer post at the Strait of Tiran, which remained there until NASA removed it in 1967.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this, of course, was UNEF-1, which mm-hmm. was established then. Now, UNEF-1 was a brilliant conception. I strongly suspect it was bunches, and it was in the drawers. I think they must have foreseen something like this coming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether they foresaw the Anglo-French part of that operation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody did until after the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company.
Right.
Which, by the way, if you look at the documentation very, very carefully, you will observe that Israel was dead silent on that, never expressed itself
mm-hmm.
on that. We had an observer at the London conference on the Suez Canal. I don't think he opened his mouth, but if he did, he certainly didn't say anything against the Egyptians. And we did not want to interfere with the Egyptian national aspirations. They were no concern of ours, as long as we could get freedom of passage.
Right. How long had there been a blockage of freedom of passage for Israel?
From 1946.
From 1946.
Yes, yes. The first Egyptian legislation, it was then directed against Zionist, whatever, goods.
So they had been gone
through the Suez Canal, but it was in 1946.
Yeah. See,
the British did nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And after the independence of 48, of course, it became much easier for the Egyptians anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They had a prize court which operated.
Mm-hmm.
And most of its decisions have been published,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Well, in the summer of 1956, then Nasser did nationalize the canal,
yeah.
which the French and the British highly objected to. Can you tell me something about the agreements at Sèvres?
No, nothing about the agreements, quite honestly, nothing uh-huh. about the agreements at Sèvres at all. Like everybody else, we were just presented with certain operational instructions.
Mm-hmm.
There is the first glimmerings, I would say, apart from what there may be in memoirs of people like Eden who were involved,
mm-hmm.
maybe in Ben Gurion, I don't remember now,
mm-hmm.
Of anything serious of the inner history is an article which was published, I suppose, in the last 2 years in the British periodical International Comparative Law Quarterly
mm-hmm.
by Geoffrey Marston of Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously had access to Foreign Office documents with quite an interesting account of how the legal people of the British Foreign Office were kept out of it.
Mm.
And my guess is that the legal people of the Israeli Foreign Office were also kept out of it, probably for the same reasons.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it was a case which got beyond legalities already, yeah. legalisms. The legal people were just left to clean up the mess, as mm-hmm. often happens, mm-hmm. by the way.
Mm-hmm. But the agreements were primarily to coordinate some kind of effort between the British
yes.
and the French and Israel.
Yes, as far as I know. I've, yeah. I've never actually seen them.
Yeah,
I don't even know whether they've been published. I suppose they have been, but
mm-hmm.
Being as I put it, an operational man on the whole, and I've been very careful in all my writings, mm-hmm. which are a lot, to avoid dealing with the Middle East. Didn't want to cause any embarrassment to any particular government of Israel or anybody else for that matter,
mm-hmm.
by writing on the Middle East. I have a certain standing in the international community,
mm-hmm.
and I've kept off Middle East and really not terribly interested myself in details of it, except when I've had to professionally, and I
right.
don't recall
right.
ever seeing the Sèvres agreement,
mm-hmm.
to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. So then, what were the parts of it that you were aware of, or what were your instructions?
My instructions were basically to do what I could to get, as I say, the freedom of navigation through both.
Yeah.
That was our prime interest.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as it was a matter for the foreign ministry, well, it wasn't really. It was the Ministry of Defence more concerned with the Fedayeen, that side of it, terrorist side of it.
Well, Israel did have issues with the Egyptians, and the fighting had been going on.
Oh, yes, yes, we had certainly had issues with the Egyptians.
But not solved.
We thought some of them had been solved by the armistice, but it turned out differently in the end. And then, of course, don't forget there was a revolution in Egypt shortly after the armistice agreement. I don't think it really affected things all that much. It affected the personalities. The king and the corrupt government disappeared, Makrashi and that crowd.
And then Nasser.
And then Nasser took over with his strong personality. And he became extremely anti-Israeli and leader of a wide anti-Israeli coalition, by no means limited to the Arabs. I mean, he was the one who really brought the Third World, what's called the Third World, into it. It's very curious, on the night that he died, in the middle of the General Assembly, and we had scheduled a reception, a Northern delegation reception that night. And some quite innocent delegate, I forgot from what country, came up to me and said, "I suppose your reception tonight will be cancelled." I said, "What for?" "Well, haven't you heard? Nasser, we should cancel a reception because Nasser's died." But that's how things go in the UN. You don't quite know who you're talking to always.
And so
there was a man before Nasser who was less hostile but less effective. That was Naguib. He also had been involved in the 48 war, and our people knew him also.
Then on October 29th in 1956, then Israel did attack Egypt. They moved it.
By the way, there was a tremendous camouflage operation went on at that time, because everybody thought that tension was between Israel and Jordan. If you look at the press carefully, you'll see that the tension that's spoken about was between Israel and Jordan. As a matter of fact, I was
so
in Europe.
So this was on purpose to deflect attention?
I don't know. I was in Europe at that time on something, and I can't remember now what took me to Europe, and I know I was recalled in a hurry round about that time, and I thought it was because war was going to break out with Jordan.
See,
don't forget, if you allow me to say so, that if war is going to break out, the last thing any military is going to do is to tell any civilian that doesn't need to know.
That doesn't need to know, absolutely. Well, at any rate, was there a feeling that that Egypt was going to attack Israel? Or was this kind of a preemption, or was it really related specifically to gaining something on the issues?
I think it was jumping onto a bandwagon. I think it was exploiting an opportunity which presented itself with Anglo-French initiatives vis-a-vis Egypt.
All right, so that it wasn't a separate issue.
No.
It was connected.
You misunderstood me.
All right.
The issues were there anyhow.
Yes.
And I think the foreign ministry had reached a conclusion, at any rate the higher echelons of the foreign ministry had reached a conclusion that the only way to get freedom of passage through Iran would be, sooner or later, by the use of force.
Right, okay.
The Egyptians would not voluntarily relinquish any of their position there.
Okay.
I think that's sort of point of departure from the whole thinking. What I think happened, and here's guesswork on my part, to some extent informed, is that when the British and the French started their initiative to use force against Nasser for whatever purpose they wanted, I think that our people, especially the Ministry of Defence, and this is Peres, as far as I know, he was the main contact in those
days. You're talking about
Shimon Peres. I think that he saw an opportunity here to get the Strait of Tehran by jumping sort of piggyback.
Right.
I don't think we had any particular. Well, the French gave us one thing, which I think was cardinal in all this. They gave us air cover over Tel Aviv, which we didn't have.
Okay.
I think that was a sort of quid pro quo. Then, if I remember rightly, the sequence of events was more or less this. We did attack Egypt. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. And if you like, well, it was provoked, it's Fedayeen, whatever. We then were presented with an ultimatum by the British and the French to cease, desist, or withdraw, whatever, within a limited period of time, or else. Mm-hmm. And it was on the basis of that, or else, that they started their operation. That's how it was done. But of course, their operation failed completely because it was so badly handled.
Right. But I think they asked for the Egyptians and the Israelis
to separate themselves.
To separate 10 miles back from the canal.
Whatever.
But the canal was in Egyptian territory.
Yeah, whatever, yes. Right. But they also mishandled it. They didn't have their troops in place. And they, but they did give us air cover over Tel Aviv, which we didn't have at that time. Our air force wasn't strong enough.
And then the UN, after the fighting broke out, called for a ceasefire and the withdrawal of forces.
Yes, but it also put the UNIF 1 in place. Now, as I say, I think the prime objective of UNIF 1 was to save face for the British and the French. Because its original disposition was to separate the English, the British and the French from the Egyptians in the Port Said.
Right.
It from there it expanded outwards and was given a role. The armistice, as far as we were concerned, the armistice was dead and buried. And Ben-Gurion made a very sharp speech in Parliament about it being dead and buried. And what did he say? All the magicians of Egypt would not put it together again. It's a quotation from the Bible. Or whatever, whatever the word is, not important. And of course, the UN would not accept that de jure, but de facto, of course, one has to accept the situation.
Right.
Because the armistice agreement disappeared, the observer, all the mixed armistice commission and the observer set up disappeared along with it. But anyhow, by that time, would not have been big enough to have observed properly this much larger area, which now came into play.
Right, right.
And one of the conditions for our withdrawal from the Gaza Strip was UN observation posts at Tehran, which remained there until 67. And there was freedom of passage through Tehran through all that period.
Right, right.
That is a link-up.
Yeah.
Which was tidied up on the legal side, as I say, through the first conference on the law of the sea, 1958, where again Arthur Dean, the same man with whom the speech, at the terms of our withdrawal were negotiated, Arthur Foster Dulles, John Foster Dulles, was head of the U.S. delegation. We knew exactly the issues that were involved, and we were, and we had there at that stage already very strong cooperation from the British and the French, who realized, I think, the significance of straits in general, which of course became a major issue in the last conference on the World Sea.
Right.
And
keeping passage open.
Keeping passage open.
Yeah.
And overflight.
And overflight. Yes. Well, the resolution to call for a ceasefire came actually from the General Assembly.
Well, what happened there was it was, I think, the first operation, the first application of the Uniting for Peace resolution. That was a resolution which was adopted in 1950 after the Security Council had been completely stymied by the Russian veto in the Korean issue. And that's when the Americans developed the idea of shifting the center of gravity of the UN from the Security Council, for the maintenance of peace, from the Security Council to the General Assembly, keeping in mind that the General Assembly resolution is never more than a recommendation, whereas the Security Council resolution.
Yes.
Now, this is quite important in all
this. Right, right.
Incidentally, we were very reserved towards that resolution, but already by that time we couldn't oppose it. I think we did privately warn the Americans that it could backfire, as it has done, of course, in a bad way. And I think one of our speeches in the UN, one or two of our speeches do express certain reserves, but that's all absolutely incidental and irrelevant today. As a result of the vetoes in the Security Council, British and French vetoes at this time, an emergency session of the General Assembly was called. But just to show you how things are linked, the US or the West managed at the same time to get the issue of Hungary before the General Assembly, before the Security Council, where it was also vetoed. And, and there was a second emergency session running in parallel over the Soviet intervention in Hungary.
That's right, 1956.
The two ran in parallel.
Yeah, it's
the most complex. You see, you can't separate this situation in one part of the world from a situation in another part of the world.
Right.
Extremely complex it was.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to check this up.
Yeah.